This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Broadband Wireless Access World. We're about to speak to Jeffrey Payne, who's the Vice President for Strategic Marketing at UT Starcom. Welcome to Broadband Wireless Access World.
Thank you, Mark.
Say a little bit about what you do as Vice President for Strategic Marketing at UT Starcom.
Yeah, strategic marketing at UT Starcom is chartered with really market entry strategies, making sure we have the new products that the markets we're moving into are requiring. The company had its gestation and foundation in the Asia market, where we have done a tremendous business that started with PHS, which is a wireless local loop technology that came out of Japan that we moved into China.
Right.
And that now has something around 80 million subscribers, for which we have about 55% market share. So we cut our teeth on, you know, building out wireless infrastructure and wireless access systems for, you know, million-person cities in China.
Okay. So doing a little city of a few million in L.A. Or in California isn't much of a stretch for you.
Well, conceivably, if the spectrum was available, right?
If the spectrum.
It's always the trick question. Right?
Spectrum was more available in China, huh?
Yes, for the PHS it was.
Okay.
So what the company has also done is taken access technologies on the wireline side. So in addition to wireless technologies, where we play in essentially every flavor of 3G, we have CDMA 2000, WCDMA or wideband CDMA. We have UMTS TDD, also known as TD-CDMA, which is actually being deployed in a number of places right now as a DSL alternative for data over wireless. We do well on the wireline side where we're the number one or two vendor in IPD slams. We do DSL modems. We're heavily into gigabit passive optical networking technologies for delivering TV over IP, high-def kinds of speeds into the home at 10 or 30 megabits.
So you're very well positioned for this broadband revolution.
Right. And so the broadband revolution is critical to our success. We also have quite a history of liking to be in the handset and the consumer set-top box type business. Well over 50% of our revenue, which this year will be something north of $3 billion, is in the handset and or set-top box space. So we have a lot of experience doing that.
Okay, for people who are excited by this and want to become investors, you have are you traded publicly?
Yes, we are traded under the symbol UTSI. We went public in NASDAQ in 2000.
Okay. Where's the stock today, do you know?
I haven't looked lately. It's about 16, last I looked, $16, $17, somewhere in that range.
Okay. We're going to mostly talk about the F1000 today. Tell us what the F1000 is and where it fits into your strategy and how it's going to fit into other people's lifestyles and business operations.
Sure. From a strategic perspective, it's clear that although 3G is a somewhat over-abused term on the wireless side, as is triple play on the wireline side, both of those things come together in this sort of a unified mobile broadband services perspective, and we have technology on both sides. So technologies that help integrate those, like Wi-Fi, become quite critical. So we looked at Wi-Fi as an interesting technology. We have our own access points, but more to the point, we actually look at integrating Wi-Fi capabilities into set-top boxes, Wi-Fi capabilities into handsets. Now, this phone is really, it's a little hard to tell from the picture, but this is truly as close to a mobile phone form factor, look and feel, performance from a battery perspective, style that we could possibly do. And so that's kind of what's been missing in the voice over IP space. You've had a lot of success in voice over IP in the enterprise, where you have, you know, Avaya and Cisco and all those guys selling, you know, very expensive phones. The phones tend to be $500 or $600 as part of IP PBX systems. But what you haven't had up to this point is a consumer-friendly, consumer comfort zone type of phone that is Wi-Fi enabled.
And the comfort level is battery life, form factor, and cost, pretty much,
and
capability.
The other sort of Wi-Fi, pure Wi-Fi phones, which is where we are in this phase of the technology deployment, are really more, from a look and feel perspective, cordless phones. They're cordless phones for the home, right? They're not something you would want to put in your pocket and in some cases couldn't put in your pocket and carry around.
Right.
Whereas this phone, a little hard to see from the picture, but I personally use a Sony Ericsson P900. It's about a third smaller than that. So this truly is a phone you can stick in your pocket. People won't even notice it's there. So from a battery perspective, what we've done, this thing has about 3 hours battery talk time, roughly 40 to 80 hours standby time. You know, normal parameters.
It means you can charge it up at night and do most of the talking you're going to want to do on it the next
right.
day.
Right. Contrast that with the sort of the only way you can do Wi-Fi voice today is really to get a Wi-Fi card that slips into a high-end sort of Trio form factor phone.
Right.
And the problem there is, as you know, Wi-Fi as a technology was not particularly designed for mobile form factors, and that card assumes it's actually in a laptop with a power cord in it. So it will suck the battery dry on a high-end phone of that form factor in about 20 minutes.
Right.
So it's not, it's a good way to play with the technology, a nice little sort of science project, but it's not, you know, it's not a consumer usable, consumer friendly.
And of course, you can carry your laptop around and hook a microphone up to it and use it that way, but that's a form factor that you can't put in your pocket.
Right. So what this phone is, from the battery perspective we've talked about, from a look and feel perspective, it is a mobile phone. And it also, unlike the other things that are out there in the market, it has the features of a mobile phone that people kind of like to use.
For example?
A calendar. It has an address book. It has ringtones. It's got wallpaper. It's got games. You know, those are things that a mobile phone has as opposed to a cordless phone. So again, we've tried to do that, and we've got it down at a price point where Vonage, which is the first customer that's going to market with us with this phone, will sell this to their customers later this year for $100.
Okay. And are you still there?
Yes.
Yes. And what kind of packages? First, what's the relationship between UT Starcom and Vonage, and for the customer, what kind of package deals will they be able to get with service and a device?
The first customer that will have this. This is a generally available product. We are clearly talking to other carriers, but Vonage is our go-to-market partner. This would actually be the second step. We also provide them with their new voicemail system. So this is the second phase of a relationship with
right.
Vonage. Their package is for $24.99. You get, well, they actually have two, but that's the primary one, where you get unlimited minutes and completely free long distance in the U.S. or Canada. So from that perspective, if you have a DSL modem or a cable modem at home and you put a Wi-Fi connector, you know, a Wi-Fi access point onto that,
right.
then, you know, you clearly do not anymore need a cordless phone in the home. It has the same range. You can walk into the backyard, you can walk upstairs, and you get Vonage's long distance plan, which is essentially free in the U.S. and Canada. Now, on the upside to that, because this phone is so nice and small and portable, you can travel with it, and if you're in an open access point anywhere in the world, you can just turn the thing on, it will register, and you can take and receive free phone calls from New Zealand, China, wherever you want.
So that means then for 25, so you pay $100 to get the device,
correct.
And you pay $24.95 a month to Vonage,
correct.
And you can wander around your home, your backyard, and every Starbucks in the world, as well as any other Wi-Fi access point, and make calls anywhere in the world for a dollar a day.
A caveat to that, it has to be an open access point. So
right.
whereas I believe Vonage is negotiating with some of the people like T-Mobile and elsewhere that have, shall we say, a priced structure
right.
where you have to have a code to get in.
Right.
This will work in any access point. So typically anybody's home that you go to that's got one of these, a lot of hotel lobbies, airport lounges, places like that are open access points. I live in a city in California where the entire downtown is open access. So I can sit down in any restaurant in my hometown, turn on my phone, and make and receive phone calls.
Which town is this?
I live in Palo Alto.
Oh.
So the other thing is when you're traveling, the other way you can help yourself out here is if you're a business traveler and you have your own laptop, you go to a hotel that may not have its own Wi-Fi access, but you can now get little small, sort of about $25 access points, take it with you, plug that in as well to the hotel's broadband connection,
right.
and now you can make and take calls from your hotel room on this for free.
Has Palo Alto already set itself up as a hot zone?
Not officially, but it was sort of one of those consumer co-op things that just kind of happened.
Oh.
So the whole downtown University Avenue is one big open Wi-Fi hotspot, and other stores in the area as well.
Is that being run by the cable co-op or by the city?
No, it's just a bunch of guys who were the merchants and everything else decided, wouldn't it be nice? So it's not a city-sponsored thing. It's not particularly promoted, but it's just a fact of life.
Of essentially the Merchants Association of University Avenue?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm glad
that was nice.
Okay, good. So, and you use? Do you have an F1000 already? Are you using it there?
I have one. It's not on at the moment. The battery's died from it. But yes, there are people in StarCom currently using the phone.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I took a phone call from somebody at StarCom in Japan yesterday, and I didn't know he was on an IP phone.
All right. Talk about this as a disruptive technology. What does that mean, and how's that going to work out?
Well, it's a disruptive technology in the sense that, you know, it doesn't have to be offered by a large regulated company.
An incumbent.
I mean, anybody can set up a Wi-Fi access point.
Right.
And if you have access to a Wi-Fi access point, have at with this phone. Vonage also has a more inexpensive plan. I think it's about $19.95. It has, you know, some minutes. I think it's 500 minutes and then the free LD.
Right.
So you're seeing more and more of this. The cable companies are starting to offer it. They tend to go higher in the $40 to $50 range on their service, but they're offering, you know, sort of primary line type services.
From what you just said, that anybody can set it up, I just came up with another application. A company that runs a football or baseball or soccer stadium mm-hmm. could set that up there, couldn't it?
Yes, as long as you probably, given the size of that, you probably need multiple access points. But
exactly.
As long as it had a single, what they call DHCP server, where it gets one IP address,
right?
Then it should work in that kind of a closed environment.
And they could then encourage or give away that service to people who show up at their games.
Right. Now, you'd have to have, you know, there would have to be some carrier attached to that. There would have to be some way to register with the network.
Right. Say a little bit about that and more and how that works. Whether when people sign up with Vonage, they're hooked up to that network, but if they go into other places, they're not? Or how does that work?
What you need is somebody providing you a service on essentially the Internet.
Right.
So there are other companies such as Primus, such as Net2Phone, and everybody else that have IP phone services.
Right.
You need to have a service from somebody, and, you know, the phone, given the state of the technology, these phones probably need to be tweaked for the service. So whereas this phone's coming to market with Vonage, if we were to look out 12 months from now and other carriers are also offering this phone, basically what happens is the phone has additional compatibilities with other routers, other SIP proxies, and all the other sort of technology that hides under the cover here.
So I have to say I haven't done it, so I'm not sure how it works. If I go into Starbucks, do I need to be – do they have a relationship with Vonage, or do they have a relationship with T-Mobile?
Not at this point that I know of.
And so the phone wouldn't work in a Starbucks.
That's correct.
Okay.
So if you're in a pay right now, if you're in a pay Wi-Fi,
right,
this is not going to work at this point in time.
It's what you're calling open access points.
Open access points mean, there are, in addition to University Avenue, I can name you a half a dozen restaurants and cafes in Palo Alto that aren't anywhere near there that also have open hotspots.
And how does a city or a business go about establishing an open hotspot for itself?
It's really simple. Basically, typically you'd have a DSL connection
right
into the restaurant for data and internet access and all that stuff, and you just plug in an access point and off you go.
And then
the access point from D-Link or Linksys or Netgear or any of those guys.
Right, and then does that provider need to have some relationship with Vonage in order for the system to work?
No, so that's an open access point, meaning people walk in with their PCs and can surf the internet.
Right, or they walk in with their F1000 and can,
right.
And if they have an account with Vonage,
then it works.
Okay.
Yeah. All they have to do is turn the phone on. What happens is you turn the phone on, the Wi-Fi in the phone finds the access point, then registers with Vonage where you are.
Right.
Right? Once that happens, you're good to go.
And how does the network know what your number is?
The number is attached to the phone. So when you register, there's a correlation that's made by Vonage, and then they do the number translation for people calling you or you calling out.
And how do the incumbent or the regulators relate to the granting of that number to the F1000 phone?
Vonage has cut, you know, they've had to pay for a certain number of direct dial numbers. So
right.
They've gone through the traditional, just like the CLEX used to do.
Right. Right. They have a database full of all those numbers, and they give them out to their customers.
Correct. So, and to be even cleverer about it or different, I mean, you could be here in Palo Alto, but say all your friends, or majority, maybe you just moved here from New York.
Right.
So all your friends are there. So
right.
You go ahead and get yourself a New York area code, but you're here in California. So when your friends call you from the standard phones,
right,
it's a free call.
So you want to get a number to – that's what I did when I got my cell phone. I live in 818, but I thought I'd be hipper, so I got a 310
area code. There you go. Same.
Okay. Talk about how this is going to work in an enterprise, in an office, a small business or a big company.
Well, it's not really designed at this point to replace the large enterprise systems that are full-blown, you know, PBX feature sets and everything else.
Okay.
You could add these phones to the mix, conceivably. If you were an IT guy at one of the enterprises, you could conceivably make sure that the phones worked with that, but you would have to provide the service somehow for this phone to go out.
Right.
To do that. An interesting application for this phone, however, would be, I guess they're declining in popularity just because of the prevalence of mobile phones, but this would be an easy thing to think of conceivably as a dormitory phone. You know, if
right.
I'm a college or university, you know, I'm going to have to provide probably Wi-Fi access on my campus anyway. And again, if I have that one server giving out IP addresses, in addition to, you know, requiring laptops, maybe I hand out a phone like this and say, here are three or four carriers,
right.
You know, with different rate plans that, you know, you can pick from. And
right.
Here's a, you know, for $100, here's your phone.
Okay, now you were talking about these open access points. Do those, does it matter whether those are 802.11 A, B, G, I, or whatever?
Well, this is an 802.11b phone, so pretty much you're going to get two kinds of access points, either 802.11b or 802.11 something combination, but B is always in there.
Okay.
Right, so fundamentally, I'm not aware of an access point that wouldn't be able to handle this.
Okay. Talk about the term multimodal and how that figures into this, what's going to be happening from your point of view and industry-wide
sure.
in terms of offering cellular and Wi-Fi in the same handset?
Happy to. Let's take this two steps. First of all, you know, phones like this are really the first foray into making this more of a mainstream acceptable population. And I sort of define mainstream mass market as nobody I know and nobody that my friends know, and maybe we go down one more layer and start there.
Right.
So, but it looks comfortable. The second phase, the sort of holy grail of these phones, is obviously a phone that is both Wi-Fi and cellular, either GSM or CDMA on the other side.
Right.
Now, there are a few phones like that out there, sort of an early style, but they're separate phones. These two systems in the phone don't talk to each other.
Right.
There's no way to, say, start a phone call on Wi-Fi, walk away from the system, and have it, you know, nicely roll over to cellular today.
Right, that's the holy grail, essentially. So
that's the holy grail. You'll start to see that in probably about 12 to 18 months, certainly. But there's a couple of problems that we have to solve as an industry. One is the battery life.
Right.
You know, we have an edge because working with the PHS phones in China, where it's a very low-cost system, people are extraordinary. It's a 20% the cost of a cell phone infrastructure, including the handsets.
Right.
We really have to optimize battery life. So that's a given for everybody. The second thing is how you do that handoff. I mean, most people say, well, gee, okay, well, if I'm in a Wi-Fi hotspot and I start my call Wi-Fi, because they'll probably all default to that because it's going to be the cheaper connection.
Right.
Right. And I start to walk out the door.
Get in the car and drive off.
Right. So a lot of the early guys say, well, hey, why don't we just go by signal strength?
Right.
Well, the problem with that is not so much the scenario I just did, but the other scenario where, let's say you're in a GSM connection, you drive up to the hotspot and you walk in.
Right.
If I'm just going by signal strength, I can get 5 bars of Wi-Fi signal strength and a completely congested network that will drop the call.
Right.
So signal strength alone probably isn't enough, but it will be a primary metric. But we have to, as an industry, be a little cleverer than that to make this seamless. And then you have the other issue of, you know, are you allowed to do that handoff? So one of the problems that the cable companies have faced is twofold. One, they really want these phones because they want to maintain that subscriber is their subscriber when he or she leaves the tether of the house.
Right.
But obviously they don't own any mobile phone companies.
Right.
they also have limited footprints. So the cable companies have carved up the United States, for example, in very definable chunks.
Right.
So that's their footprint. What happens when they go into, if I'm a Comcast guy and I go to New York and I'm in Cablevision, what do I do?
Right.
So you've got that issue, and then you've got, well, who do I cut an agreement with? Well, typically, the cable companies are probably not likely to go and partner with the RBOX, who have mobile phones, because they've been sort of mortal enemies.
Right.
So there's really only a couple of options, but no one can seem to agree on, you know, who owns the number, you know, sort of who gets to drive and who's the kid.
Right.
Is still an open question.
Is this yet another set of circumstances that are calling for the rewriting of the Telecom Act of 1996?
I don't think that's going to be required. I think the economics will get this to work. The upside is just too big. The revenue stream is just too big, and not doing it is just too much of an issue in terms of damage to the company.
So what do you envision is going to happen technically and commercially for this?
I think that the broadband providers will peer with, they'll have peering agreements with some set of mobile companies, mobile phone providers.
Right.
So that the back end, the billing, the handoff, you know, which minutes gets charged to what plan, et cetera, is all sort of hidden from the end user. And it's bundled by whoever's providing that phone.
Right? So essentially, on the user end, it's going to be necessary to figure out some algorithms for optimizing the usage on which band you're dealing with.
Right.
And then at the server end, it's going to be necessary to work out some pretty complicated billing arrangements to figure out who collects what from whom and how it's distributed.
Yeah, settlements... The settlement issue doesn't go away in this environment. When you're going from IP to a non-IP, to a classic TDM or mobile phone.
Okay. How much would it help your business if more cities started providing more open access points throughout their geographical extent?
I don't know how much effect it would have on the business. I think it would have a psychological effect that this technology is going to be around. You know, it's not going to be a flash in the pan, that it's a growing wave and not just sort of isn't that interesting kind of thing that we've seen a few of those. So I think it's important that the technology gets deployed. I think you will see it just as a matter of course in almost any set-top box, you know, 2 years from now, whoever provides it to your home.
Okay. No, I'm talking about in cities, essentially
yeah.
doing for all of the Mid Peninsula what University Avenue has now.
Right.
Doing it for all the cities and essentially creating clouds everywhere of open access Wi-Fi connectivity.
Well, you know, I think competition is a good thing, and you know, if you know hypothetically, if Menlo Park decides it's losing you know revenue to people who are deciding to go to Palo Alto to have coffees and eat and drink because they can make free phone calls.
Right.
That's and the cost of putting this stuff in a small city isn't prohibitive at all.
Right.
It's actually fairly trivial. It's certainly less than putting up cell towers.
Right.
And you don't have the sort of, shall we say, social issues of people not wanting cell towers in their neighborhood or in their church steeples.
Right.
So, you know, it's a fairly nondescript thing to deploy. It's not very costly. I mean, you can get access points as cheap as $25 now. So this is fairly easy to do.
Okay. Talk about set-top boxes and how they compare to this and what the possibilities of using Wi-Fi and products that you've got or that other companies have to allow a real explosion in the number of channels that people will be able to get video from by using Wi-Fi to set-top boxes and accessing servers that have video on demand there.
Yeah, I think Wi-Fi speeds won't do a whole lot for what they call TV over IP or
right.
TV over DSL or TV over fiber or you know cable to at some level.
You don't think wireless will be the way that goes?
Well, I think wireless will be attached to the. Well, let me give you an example.
Right.
I mean, if you look at TiVo's new, it's called TiVo to Go.
Right.
If you have a very strong signal, in other words, your PC that you're going to transfer this movie to a standard definition. We're not even talking high def here.
Right.
You know, with a reasonable signal strength, it's probably 2 to 2.5 hours, maybe 3 hours to transfer that.
Right.
you know, that's, you know, that's non-trivial. And if you're in another room away from the access point, it can probably run to 7, 8, 9 hours.
Right.
So the speeds of Wi-Fi don't actually get you there. What probably gets you there is some of the other technologies that we're talking about. You know, we're deploying a thing called TD-CDMA, which is in most of the world called UMTS-TDD. And what that is, it uses available spectrum in most countries. Certainly Europe has got it, New Zealand's got it. The spectrum is available in the U.S. And today, it's sort of like WiMAX now.
Right.
But you don't have to wait. And there's one service that we're talking to. We turned a company on in outside of London in the West River Valley called UK Broadband. And they are offering two services. One's a 512K and one's a 1 meg wireless service.
Right.
Right now it's just data, but it won't have to be just data. You know, when you're getting to 1 meg, and we can probably take that to 2 by going from 10 to 20 megahertz. When you do that, 2 megabits, you can easily do MPEG-4 compression video.
So a network like that would support a set-top box hooked up to a plasma wall-sized TV and put whatever you can get off the server onto the wall.
Well, now that's no. If you yes, but
okay.
Now, if you're talking high def,
right,
which I think most people who are actually going to put plasma TVs on their walls are talking,
right?
Yeah, you really need about absolute minimum 6 megabits.
All right.
Right. So other technologies, so sort of the ultra wideband stuff,
right,
which has shorter duration. So you can either wire your home for sort of 100 meg. Or fiber, or you can go moving forward to even higher speed in-home technologies for wireless.
So where is the priority for UT Starcom in providing that kind of ultra-wide broadband into the home or into the enterprise?
Our priority is to really enable the wired telcos, the RBOCs, the PTTs, and things like that,
right,
actually be able to compete head-to-head with the DSS and cable. So we're putting a big emphasis on the higher-end ADSL 2+, 2++, VDSL on the DSL side. We have all those products. Plus, we're pushing very aggressively because we've got sort of disruptive price points at gigabit passive optical networking into the home. So we actually have a new TV over IP system that can give you both the access network and get you about 10 megabits into the home on fiber, plus the TV over IP solution itself for, less than $300 a subscriber.
All right.
And those are radically lower prices than what's out there, because we think that the key to making this really interesting is not so much initially the ultra-wideband in the home, but to actually break the broadcast model, right? In our system, it's capable enough in its first revision that I can store every film ever made at the edge of the network for you to call down when you want. So this makes 400 or 500 channel systems, you go, so?
Right.
Now, that being said, what you've done is you've inverted the model. You have an internet-style, I decide what I want to watch, when, and everything, not some limited number of channels or some limited number of content points. Now, that being said, user acceptance is always the big issue.
And right? What is that user acceptance going to depend on? Price points? And
well, no. I think, remember, user acceptance for Wi-Fi, we think the F1000 phone is a form factor that people will be comfortable with and will actually use.
Right.
Same paradigm for TV over IP. We believe you have to assume that the television, not a PC, is the interface.
Right.
There.
Right.
People use that. And that the remote control to the television is the interface.
Right.
Not a PC someplace in the home. Now, there's always going to be, in-home networks and edge of the bell curve people who will always have that capability. So, in our system, instead of a TiVo, you look at TiVo and digital video recorders, right? As much publicity and as sexy as that stuff is and as interesting as that stuff is, only 2% of the population have one after all this time. And you ask yourself, well, why is that? And you say, well, basically, it's another box. It's a new box, It does something different. I'm not comfortable with that. I have a separate remote control for that than I do for my TV. I'm not comfortable with that. So, you know, we all have to adopt the model that the mass market consumer is much more like Homer Simpson's grandfather than anybody else.
But so, in fact, what you're talking about doing for television is what the F1000 does for cell phones. It looks like the old, to call cellular old is weird, but it looks like the old standard, but it works through IP.
Right. So
you want to do the same thing with the television.
Instead, you don't need channels.
Right.
I think you have to recreate them for quite some time. So you come up with the concept of a virtual channel.
Right.
That you can present to the user because he or she is going to expect channels.
Ah, okay.
Okay. And eventually you say, here are your virtual channels, but look over here. You know, here's, 10,000 films you can download.
Right.
Or niche content. You know, here's programming from Australia.
Right. So the idea essentially is essentially putting new wine in old bottles of saying you can now access any video file that exists.
Right.
But you're going to do it through the Aussie channel and the channel about home networking,
right.
and so on. And so it'll look like you're going to this channel, but in fact what you're doing is accessing a file through the same IP system that...
Right.
So there are
three things that I call them the three TiVo time bombs.
Right.
The three TiVo time bombs are none of them individually are damning, but collectively they make you scratch your head. The first one is it's a fact of life that people don't like noisy things in their living rooms and noisy things interfering with their viewing pleasure. So fans tend to make noise. So a lot of these digital video recorders or personal video recorders don't have fans.
Right.
Don't have cooling fans, which means they run hot because people are told not to put them in cabinets, but people are going to put them in cabinets.
Right.
And the failure rate on the disk drives is actually much, much higher than the industry likes to talk about.
Because it would work if you could put them in one of those cold rooms that you put all the servers in, but people
right.
aren't going to build those in their house.
So what happens is you have some, let's call it for the sake of this discussion, some 10% of your population on a rotating basis is annoyed with you as a carrier, because their box just died, and everything on it just died, and you as a carrier are not in the business of data recovery, so you send them a new box.
Right.
Now, damning? No. Annoying? Oh, yeah. Number two, when you record something on a TiVo-type box, I'm not singling out TiVo.
Right.
Recording something on that type of box, you don't actually own the content. You own the content while it's transiting the disk drive capacity of your box, and then when you record something else, something falls out the bottom once you filled it.
Right.
So that could be, Jimmy's soccer game that you picked up on local news, 4 months ago that you would really like to keep, but you decide to record Master and Commander, and whoops, it's gone.
Right.
You know, unpleasant, uncomfortable, damning, no. The third thing is, and this is just a brutal fact, high definition, assuming we go there, and I think we will, makes every TiVo type box that's shipped today obsolete.
Because it takes up so much space.
Yeah, you need about, for reasonable high-def storage, about a 500-gigabyte hard drive. And the biggest one out there that I've seen yet is 320. And almost all of them have 40, 60, or 80.
So what's the solution to all of these problems taken together? Is there one?
There's two solutions. In the type of system that we have created the capacity for what's called a network PVR, where fundamentally you can essentially buy things from the carrier, whoever's delivering, whether it's in the future SBC or whoever, so you can say, okay, I want to purchase episode 73 of Friends,
right?
And I want it to be mine. It's mine, right? So
right.
What happens is the carrier will store that. There'll be an indexed file for you in the network.
Right.
It says that's yours. Not only that, the carrier will have back that up, so there's no single point of failure like the burned out disk drive problem. So
does it mean that you're essentially reserving it for
yeah.
you, and you've got a separate iteration, a separate copy of the file?
You probably don't have a separate copy of the file. You have rights to the stored copies that are backed up in the network.
So the same way a directory on your computer points to the file, and you can point to it from several points on your computer.
Yeah.
Many people will have the rights to episode 73.
Right.
But you'll only have one, or I mean, you'll have 10 to back it up, but you won't have as many copies as you have people with the rights to it.
Right. So what happens is DVRs, I don't think, go away. They change. And I think what happens is instead of the carrier providing the personal video recorder,
right,
if it's got this network capacity, it's essentially a big library, right? I mean, everything's out there for me to have rights to.
Right.
But I want one in my home, too. So unlike the typical personal video recorders, particularly coming from the cable guys that are in some cases such a closed system that they won't even power on unless they're connected to the network.
Right.
You can go down to Fry's or Best Buy or whatever, buy the best box that you want with all the USB interfaces, FireWire interface, whatever you want. You can put your videos in there, your photos in there. It's your box.
Right.
And if it fails, you can try to do data recovery. And so what will happen is you'll store your personal things on there, and you will store probably the things you watch a lot, right? So it becomes the moral equivalent of a speed dial system.
Right.
Whereas most of the stuff you own and have rights to and access is in the network at your beck and call. Yeah, a few things will be parked in your home, and that's fine too. And if they die, okay, you can try to fix that. And it takes all the customer support onus away from the carriers explaining to people, well, I'm sorry your disk drive died, and I'm sorry this, but...
So mostly you'll have keys showing that you have the right to episode 73.
Right.
On your own system, and it'll go out and get it and bring it back.
Right.
All right. Well, we've gone out and brought back some information from you. I want to thank you for talking to
sure.
us today.
Pleasure.
And as this rolls out, I hope we could talk again, and you can bring us up to date on the future again.
Delighted, Mark. It was great. Good fun.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.